Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit the archives page at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Charles Hood, and we will be discussing his new book, Nature at Night: Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. Naturalist and adventurer, Charles Hood's new book, Nature at Night, is an illuminating and beautifully crafted exploration of the nocturnal world. With wit, curiosity, and an adventurous spirit, Charles takes readers on a journey into the darkness, revealing the astonishing life that thrives when the sun goes down. The book is as much a visual spectacle as it is a scientific deep dive. The 240-plus stunning images bring to life an unseen world, from bioluminescent oceans to stealthy predators of the jungle. Charles writes masterfully, balancing engaging storytelling with rich ecological insight, making even complex natural phenomena accessible to the general audience. Charles lives in the Mojave Desert near Los Angeles. He is a poet, essayist, photographer, and field guide author, as well as professor emeritus, and the proud caretaker of two dogs, two kayaks, and two mountain bikes. Retired from full-time teaching, he serves on the board for Friends of the Antelope Valley Indian Museum. For more information, you can visit his website, which is charleshoodbooks.com. It's real easy, charleshoodbooks.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Charles to the show. Good day, Charles.
I am so happy to be with you.
Let's start with, you know, you've written a lot of books. So what inspired you to write this particular book?
I think when we talk to your listeners and we say, hey, imagine nature. Think about nature. You know, you have a blue sky, a green meadow, maybe some butterflies, you know, going by. The sun is shining, the birds are chirping. And that's all fine. Of course, that's a legitimate aspect of the world we live in, the planet we live on. But what about the other half of the day, which is to say nature doesn't turn off in the evening, it's 24 hours. So I'm really interested in what's happening when no one's paying attention, or at least we're not paying attention. We tall, vertical, bipedal people that we are, we're not paying attention. What's going on after dark?
Yeah, you know, and, you know, quite honestly, that, you know, what goes on, nature-wise, what goes on after dark, I never gave much thought to. Now, I love to go out and do my walks in nature during the daytime and take all kinds of pictures of birds and plants and you know, any kind of beasts or creatures that cross my path. But I don't really think I've ever done an evening exploration of nature.
We pick up some nice attributes when we're out at night, and because we have limited vision, just because there's less light, we have to kind of crank up or amp up our other senses. And so your smell is activated, your hearing is activated, and you're participating in a three-dimensional world in a way that you might be less likely to during the day. Not that we don't smell things during the day, but at night you're hyper-acute, and often in the evening in the northern hemisphere, it's more humid at night, so the smells are enhanced that way, just you know, the property of the air is carrying the smells better, but we're very, very alert to them. And so even doing a little half-mile nature trail, but doing it at night, it makes it a completely new experience.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that after reading your book, that is one of those things that I'm going to, you know, actively explore and try and see what I can find. Now, you mentioned about daytime nature, you know, kind of the birds and the sun and all that kind of thing. Now, do you think that there may be a hesitancy or maybe even some mild fear of venturing out at night to do this kind of exploration?
Up your language there. It's not just mild fear. Oh my gosh, society has trained us to be terrified. You know, if you don't have three deadbolts on your front door and a security camera, you know, the werewolves are going to break in and get you. And it's just, you know, it's just balderdash. I don't know what to tell your listeners. Like, you know, even like getting into a car, a modern car, you know, new cars, like all the lights go on inside the car when you get in. Like, I don't need those lights. I know where the steering wheel is. The steering wheel is exactly where I left it the last time I got in the car. I know where the seat is. And by having all those dome lights go on when you get onto a car at night, it ruins your night vision. So you're actually a less safe driver. You're actually reducing your ability to see at night because you've lost your night vision that you were accumulating if you left the house to get into your car. So we have been trained to think, you know, bad animals, bad people, bad vampire bats, bad werewolves, all the bad stuff happens at night. We're afraid of the darkness. We're afraid of dark things. Black dogs are more feared than a white dog. A white wolf is more treasured as an animal. You know, I saw a white wolf in Alaska. You know, oh, wow, that's so great. And so I don't know what to say. Like, other than it's just not true. It just simply ain't. It ain't nothing out there is trying to get you. Calm down, everybody. Just calm down. Put that gun down. You're fine.
Yeah. Now, you know, one would need to be careful when walking in maybe, you know, snaky kinds of areas. But
sure, we want common sense. We want your listeners to practice common sense. And number one, have a backup flashlight because you're going to break the first one. You're going to drop it in the stream and the batteries are going to go dead. That's inevitable. You only have one light. You're going to break it and lose it. That's inevitable. So have a backup flashlight. Go with a friend if you're a little bit, you know, scout the route ahead of time during the daytime, all these things. And yeah, watch where you're stepping. Please don't step on any snakes. It's bad for you and bad for the snake. This is the common sense podcast that we're doing right now, y'all. Use common sense. But what we don't need to do is be just full of trepidation inherently just because the sun has gone down. That's the strange thing that we've been trained to do, to be so afraid that we don't, you know, that we don't even want to try going out at night, that we just feel like we better lock the door and stay indoors. And that's a sad loss. It's just so beautiful. You know, just even looking at the moon itself, it's such a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Now, I do say I will go out and take my full moon pictures. You know, I do venture out at night. But I do need to kind of...
I'll offer a tip for our listeners. If you know anybody at all with an amateur telescope, and that would be many of the bird watchers have spotting scopes that work as fine astronomical telescopes at the same time. Go out at about a one-quarter moon, you know, but noon going into the half full, that sort of crescent moon phase. Look up at the moon with your borrowed telescope, and you'll be astounded at the topography that is visible in the raking light. I hope that made sense. You can see all the mountains at the edges of craters, very sharp. They're just the average birdwatching, you know, the entry-level birdwatching telescope, entry-level astronomy telescope. Borrow somebody else's or go to a star party if there's a local astronomy club. And the full moon with a telescope is a little bit more problematic. It actually is so bright, you almost want to wear sunglasses if you want to see details. If you're staring up at a full moon with any kind of, you know, anything brighter than binoculars, you know, that even high-powered binoculars can make the moon pretty bright. But a quarter moon is not so bright, and the topography is just in super sharp relief. It's so fun. It's like a tour of geography.
Wow. Yeah. I have noticed when I've done the crescent moon, you know, the one that I think it's, I can't remember which movie studio has it, the boy hanging on the moon, you know, fishing from the moon. Yeah. You know, that kind of just prompted me to, you know, try to capture that phase of the moon when I can. And I do notice, you know, that it's the mountains, you know, are much more distinct. You know, I mean, the edge of the moon is just so much more distinct, you know, than when I've ever done full moon.
Well, yeah, quarter moon photography now is difficult because depending on your lens and, you know, and how much light, how high your ISO is on your camera body, to get a little bit technical. And of course, the planet is always moving. We're on this sphere that's, you know, hurtling through space and rotating. So any exposure longer than 15 seconds is going to start blurring a little bit, unless you've got a tracking device on it. So I admire you for trying, though. You're a very ambitious photographer.
Well, I've got a very long zoom lens. So, you know, it really helps me when I take pictures of the alligators in the South Carolina ponds and in the neighborhood. So I always keep my distance. one of the things, let's talk first about animals at night, the nocturnal animals. Is it in their genes, you know, or are there various reasons why they are nocturnal versus daytime animals?
There's a lot of plasticity in animal behavior. So mm-hmm. if we were to go back 400 years, I would guess that coyotes might well have been more diurnal, more, you know, or crepuscular, so either during the daytime or out at sunset. And now in urban North America, coyotes are primarily nocturnal, or more so than you know, majority of their time. And there's lots of reasons for that. They are stealing pet food off back porches. They're stealing the pet mm-hmm. cells. They're getting into the rubbish bins. They're crossing the freeway when there's less traffic. They're avoiding the people that don't like coyotes that are trying to haze them away out of the neighborhood. So they have, through just some flexibility of behavior, shifted over to be more nocturnal. But we don't necessarily know that when they were scavenging bison, you know, 400 years ago on the plains, that they were as nocturnal then as they are now. And that's true even for a jaguar. They're opportunistic, so if they have an opportunity to get some turtles on a riverbank in the middle of the day, of course they'll do it. But the things that the jaguars are typically hunting, these sort of animals called pacas, P-A-C-A, they're nocturnal. They're little black, like a guinea pig the size of a poodle dog, and they're dark with these white spots, and they're on the forest floor at night. And so the jaguar, with its phenomenal night vision, its phenomenal sense of smell, its incredibly quiet, stealthy way of walking, is then going to be out at night as well to eat the pacas. It doesn't necessarily only need to be out at night. It can hunt during the day if that's possible. You know, there are jaguars in Arizona, you know, wild jaguars that come up from Mexico. There always were jaguars in Arizona. We know from historical records that they got as far north as the Grand Canyon, all the way up at the northern part of Arizona. And they've been found in almost every county historically in Arizona. But right now in southeastern Arizona, where the birdwatchers like to go, there are typically one to two jaguars at any given time in modern times. And we know that one of them, you know, they get radio collared. One of them ate a bear. For those of you who, you know, like, if it's sort of a hypothetical, you know, kid game, right? What would, you know, if a shark fought an ostrich, who would win kind of thing? Like,
right.
Yeah, the jaguar ate the bear. And one thing for our listeners, like, tigers are bigger than jaguars, but actually jaguars have more bite strength per square inch. If we imagine, you know, we can measure pressure. The pressure, a jaguar can bite with such pressure, it can actually eat a sea turtle, not by scooping the innards out through the flipper holes, but actually can bite through the shell of a sea turtle. I just love sharing a hemisphere with this animal.
Wow, absolutely. Yeah, that's that is some vicious or very strong animal. And I didn't realize that jaguars were, you know, as north as Arizona, too. So very interesting. That's, you know, quite honestly, that is one of the things I love about your book, is there are so many different factoids, or, you know, different things, interesting bits of information about the animals that I have never heard before. So I, you know, really enjoy going through and exploring this. It's one of those books that I could read over and over and over and pick up something new each time when I read it, which is a good thing. So when it comes time to putting together this book, where there are a lot, as I mentioned, there's, you know, a good number of photos throughout the book, excellent photos. I believe you used, you know, combination, or used photos from different sources, correct? Different people?
I was at the time, and then other times I relied on the people. I was on the same trip, you know, side by side with somebody, and I said, here, I'll hold the light, you take the picture. Right. And then other times, I wasn't there. Like the Oncilla, we have a great picture of an Oncilla, a little wild cat from Northern and South America. And I wasn't there for that photograph, but the person who took it, Phil Telfer, was kind enough to loan it to me.
Right.
You know, if you ask people nicely, it's surprising. People are generally pretty nice about it. And, you know, I say, look, I'll get you a copy of the book and I'll buy you a donut. Can I have your picture?
just give me credit.
Everybody's credited. We never use without permission.
Right. And I think, you know, photographers appreciate, you know, their images, you know, being shared among, you know, the public, you know, just because it's, you know, it's something that, you know, they're interested in and they want, you know, kind of want, you know, want other people to be able to be interested in it and maybe even, you know, stimulate them or get them, you know, motivated, you know, to do the same kind of photography as well.
I know that you're a photographer, and so maybe you can appreciate the fact that the book has no deer in the headlights shots, if you know what I mean. You know, that sort of animal frozen and too much, you know, bathed in the spotlight of the interrogation lamp or something.
Right.
And that's partly because my assistant, Jose Gabriel, and I, when we travel, we bring fashion lighting equipment with us. So the cover of Vogue magazine, they use a very diffused flash typically for most fashion shoots. And we use the same lighting when we're photographing bats so that, A, we're not stressing the animal, and, B, we're sort of wrapping the animal in a soft, flattering light to end up with a portrait that is, as I think, as charming as any, you know, human portrait could be. I want these animals to feel friendly, approachable, not so fearsome, not so ugly, to be honest.
Right. Now, that one chameleon, the rhinoceros, the chameleon, you know, that one is, you know, I wouldn't say ferocious, but I mean, it is kind of a funny looking thing, creature.
Yeah, that's in Madagascar. For those of you who aren't familiar with this particular animal, it's a spiny looking lizard thing, and it's got eyes that, you know, swivel in their little sockets. But the front of the nose looks like it's got a tiny chainsaw epoxy to the front of its face. It's like it's not like a dinosaur exactly. It's like half dinosaur, half chainsaw. Rhinoceros chameleon. And, you know, that's a good example of us using a flashlight to find it and then to help the cameras focus. But the actual light is off camera, and it's a pretty large diffuser on a flash unit that has been dialed way down. I don't want to get technical. A lot of your readers like, I use my phone. Yeah, I know the phones do a lot of magic for us. I appreciate it. For those of you who are in the photography, we're setting the flashes manually much below the typical, you know, the auto settings, and we're heavily diffusing the light. So that particular, and then in Photoshop afterwards, I make sure everything looks, you know, clean and sharp and evenly balanced. Yes, there are some good, there's a great chameleon picture in this book, y'all, Nature at Night. Buy it and give it away to anyone who likes chameleons.
Exactly. Well, and we'll mention a few other, you know, creatures along the way that if people are interested in. For example, one of my favorite subjects to photograph is a dragonfly. And you have, in your book, you talk about a globe skimmer or wandering glider, a dragonfly that makes a transoceanic journey. And, you know, and the fact, you know, that it covers 11,000 miles. So, you know, can you share with the listeners a little bit about that, you know, that creature, that dragonfly, and this particular migration that they encounter or they take upon?
It's so interesting. So most of us know that dragonflies hunt around ponds and streams typically. You can't see them in the desert, but they're typically about water. And they need to lay their eggs in water, and then they have a larval stage that's under the water. And then when they finally are done, they have wings and they're above ground. And the question that an interesting question a biologist was asking himself, this is Charles Anderson, in the Maldives Islands, is like, where are the dragonflies breeding? Because the Maldives are in the Indian Ocean, and they're these coral atolls. They're great, you know, world famous for their scuba diving, but they don't have ponds. I mean, they have swimming pools that are chlorinated, but naturally there are no ponds. So the water has to be brought up from subsurface well. So he's like, wait a minute, why are there dragonflies? And then he would notice they would be there part of the year and then gone part of the year. And ultimately, he's the one that figured out they're doing this transoceanic migration, just as you were describing. They start in India. They're following the monsoon winds as the seasons shift through that part of the world around the equator. And then they end up in the Maldives during that rainy season. Then they end up in East Africa. And then they end up in South Africa. And these are multiple generations. So each segment of the trip is being carried out by one population. They lay their eggs, and through the miracle of genetics, the babies know what to do next, which is to follow the winds to the next spot, and then end up back in India a year later when the rains are there, and breeding then in the ponds in India, and then end up back in the Maldives. And then, yeah, the different common names for the same animal, global skimmer, you know, that's sort of a generic one. And some of the pictures I took and some of those I got from an Indian source. But I just think it's amazing. Yeah, these tiny little dragonflies are up navigating global winds, crossing entire oceans. Like, wow.
I found that fascinating. I mean, you know, because it does go into the genetics, you know, of that being passed on from generation to generation, and just the idea that, you know, the completion of this migration, you know, from India, Africa, and back, that the fact that it takes several generations, you know, to be able to accomplish that. To me, it's kind of like, you know, this, you know, insect plays a small part in this huge picture that, you know, we now can see, but, you know, I'm sure they themselves, you know, don't have a clue, maybe, you know, other than instinct as to what is going on.
A lot of people don't appreciate that when the dragonflies are in their larval form, when they're under the water in their aquatic phase, before they get their wings and emerge, they're actually very ferocious. They're sort of the little miniature T-Rexes of the pond, and they are busy, you know, eating tadpoles that are many times larger than themselves. They're ferocious little beasts. They're just, you know, we want to say, you know, ounce for ounce, what's more, you know, fearsome, a tiger or a dragonfly? Ounce for ounce, you know, gram for gram, the dragonfly is going to take on bigger prey and be more voracious in how it consumes them.
Wow, yeah, that's in your book you also had a picture of a flame skinner dragonfly with in the description it indicated that there was a lotus or water lily behind it, you know, kind of, and I got a picture of one of those but I had no idea what it was called, you know, and it was also near water lilies, which are one of my favorite subjects as well for photographing. So
I'll give you a plug. If you're in North America, there is a field guide to dragonflies that came out 6 months ago, and it's exhaustive and it's big and expensive. But if you want to know, there's actually flame skimmers. There's a couple of lookalikes. The thing on dragonflies in North America is usually a lookalike for any given species. So you may well have seen a flame skimmer that may look exactly like mine. But when you have one in the field, you're supposed to check, like, the way the veins are in relation to the clear part of the wing, where the little, you know, the wings are relatively clear, but there's be a little red panel that starts closer to the body, and the way that, like, the segments of the body, I'm not a dragonfly guy, but I do know that you have to be cautious if you want to be specific down to the exact animal. But I've got a funny story about the dragonfly that's in the book, which is, you know, it's in focus, y'all, and, you know, it's clear. And it's lined up on the lily pad to make a white moon behind the, you know, so the dragonfly shows up against the pond background. But I was drinking a glass of wine. That picture is taken at a place called the Norton Simon Museum of Art, which is in Pasadena, sort of an underrated, fabulous, small art museum. And they have an outdoor garden. Or the idea that's under reconstruction right now. They have an outdoor garden where you can get your wine and your almond croissants and just sort of soak up the California sunshine in the perfect 7-degree weather, listening to the birds, you know, go by. And then there were, at the time, there was a hatch of dragonflies going by. So I had to, like, walk all of, like, maybe half a meter from, like, I was sitting right at the edge of the pond, you know, my chair. I got to get up and walk a foot and a half away, take this picture. You know, life is so difficult being a naturalist.
it can be challenging. But then again, you know, there are times when you can't pass up, you know, an opportunity, you know, that you know that if you blink too long, it will be gone.
Yeah, the worst part of that session, I walked all around the pond. I brought a macro lens because I knew I wanted to take pictures of dragonflies that day. I knew they were there. Actually, I got scolded by the guards because apparently there's sculptures all around the pond and there's a walking path. And I left the walking path to stand on the grass to get closer to the dragonflies. And, oh, no, you can't stand on the grass. The guards were very upset with me. Stay on the path. Like, oh, come on now. It's mowed grass. I'm not going to fall into an 18-inch deep pond and drown. Come on, y'all. But, you know, rules. Yeah. Them rules are rules. I don't know. You know, somehow I always annoy the museum guards at our museum. I get too close to the art because I don't have my reading glasses on. I want to I like looking at the art just with my unaided eyes, which means I have to really peer close to read the wall tags and see the details. And so I'm always getting scolded for being too close, too loud, too vulgar. You know, like, holy smokes, look at this, Madge. You know, like, I don't follow the decorum of the art museum.
Wow. You know, what can you say? You know, follow your instincts.
I paid my admission like everybody else.
That's right.
In fact, exactly. I'm a member of the Norton Simon, so I get to walk on the grass as far as I'm concerned. Hello, Norton Simon guards. I paid my membership. I get to be there.
Yes, sir. So now, one of the other areas that you discuss in the book are about fireflies. You know, and in the section you indicate fireflies or beetles, that there are more than 2,000 different species. And one thing that just stood out to me is it said some eat pollen, some are predatory, and some don't eat at all. And that some don't eat at all just kind of slapped me in the face. It's like, what? So do tell about, you know, the fireflies, you know, and you gave them a prominent section in the book. So tell us about, you know, your, I guess, fascination or maybe some of the things you learned about fireflies that listeners may not know.
Well, for me, fireflies are the Hollywood sign. And I mentioned that, like, whenever people come to Los Angeles, they want their picture taken by the Hollywood sign, you know what I mean? Or they want to, you know, but when we see a movie star, they have to go to Hollywood Boulevard. And, like, of course, I live in Southern California, and I don't want to see the Hollywood sign at all. It's an irritating thing to me. But to me, because where I live, we don't have fireflies. If I go to some place like South Carolina, for example, or Borneo, I didn't have fireflies there, too. Like, they are just mesmerizing to me. But in terms of the eating thing, you know, the whole point of an animal is not to eat. The whole point of an animal is to pass on its genetic material to the next generation. And so there's a mammal in Australia, a little possumy kind of thing, called a quoll, Q-U-O-L-L, quoll. And the males spend so much of their energy trying to mate. They're so frantic in seeking a mate out that once they have successfully mated, they die. I mean, it almost sounds like a metaphor, like, you know, the French use the term, you know, the petit mort for the key moment of recreational procreation. And here's an animal that doesn't even, like, that's it. I fulfilled my purpose in life. Nothing will ever be better than this. There's no eclair out there that's better than what I've just done. That's it. I'm going to die. And the female doesn't, you know, bite him or kill him or do anything. It's not like a spider thing, like a praying mantis. They just frenetically work themselves to death chasing around after women.
Wow.
So I guess there's maybe a moral lesson. Here's our moral lesson for your listeners. Moderation in all things. Don't be like the quoll. Save some for next time and be sure to eat a sandwich. On date night.
Exactly. Boy, that's fascinating, you know. And, you know, I just think there are so many unique stories of creatures that, you know, some of them seem too fantastical to be true, you know, but they are.
Well, we have a lot of stories about animals, and some maybe originated in fact and got twisted through myth or something. It's hard to know. So, you know, in mythology that goes back to the Middle Ages in Northern Europe, the pelican was seen as being Christ-like because the myth was that the babies were starving, so the mother plucked you know, her own breast to produce, you know, blood, and then that the babies ate the blood from her breast, and that the mother died in self-sacrifice to the children. And we all know that that's not how pelicans raise baby pelicans. It's by, you know, stabbing the mom doesn't stab herself in the tummy. However, that might have come from just observing the way that a pelican has to preen. You know, they've got a sharp bill tip, and they need to spread oil over their feathers so they can be waterproof for their diving. So watching preening or watching removal of ticks, and then perhaps then the mother fed the young, right, you know, regurgitated some, the young woke up from their little nap and they got some regurgitated fish or something. It may have started as natural observation, even if it got turned into a Christian metaphor for the self-sacrifice of the female.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, how tales and stories change through the years, or, you know, are applied differently depending on norms. One of the other sections of your book is called Here Come the Moths, Plant Pollination After Dark. And then you also talk about in the desert that datura flowers bloom at night to entice moths. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, because, you know, the idea of plant pollination after dark, it seems that that might be a really difficult task, you know, to locate and pollinate.
Well, the datura, and many of your listeners may know it by sight, it's a common genus in the desert Southwest and all the way into Central America. It's a very white, showy flower. It's like the size of a child's trumpet. You know, it's a pretty big flower, and it's white so that, you know, things can find it in the darkness. And the, you know, datura is also called loco weed or Jimson weed, and we'll do our little safety announcement that it is hallucinogenic and don't mess with it. All parts of that plant are toxic. Don't, this is not for amateurs. This is something that the Native Americans who had shamanistic traditions and knew what they were doing could ingest portions of this, treat the plant and ingest it to induce visions. But if you want to get animals to come visit you at night, you know, be a white showy flower, and that's going to, you know, you don't even need moonlight to see a datura. They're easy to see because they like disturbed habitats, so they're all along roadsides. I think we do have them in the American Deep South, but they may be hard to see because the vegetation is generally so lush. You know, there's so many other things along the roadside. But certainly in more open habitat in chaparral and especially in the deserts, it's easy. They have kind of a dark green, looks like a potato, like a dark green leaf, and they're about a foot and a half tall, and they're about 3 feet around. And they, if they have one white flower, they typically have more than one. And the flowers last into the daytime. It's not like they close up entirely, but their primary source is being pollinated by hawk moths. In their primary source of pollination is at night. And, of course, if you're in the desert, it makes sense to be open at night because you don't lose all of your nectar. You know, it doesn't boil away under the bright noon sun. And so you can expend less energy producing nectar if you're nocturnal that way.
That makes sense. So nature adjusting to its environment. Now, one other area that you talk about that I had no idea what it was about is the ocean environment of the Dial Vertical Migration, or DVM, and you also talk about night-feeding dolphins chasing nocturnal squid. So do tell. I mean, I didn't know anything about the Dial Vertical Migration.
So we think about migration as being terrestrial and kind of diurnal, but frankly, like we would, if I said imagine migration of, on the planet, we'd imagine wildebeest in the Serengeti or the caribou in Alaska or something, or maybe the geese flying south, you know, for the winter. But reality is the true large migration is not there. It's actually in all the oceans of the world, 24 hours a day cycle, and then 365 days out of the year. It's always happening. So trillions and trillions and trillions of organisms are moving vertically up from the depths. So sunlight ends at about 300 feet during the day. You know, during the daytime, light penetrates down a couple hundred feet, and then it kind of peters out. So lots of animals that want to feed at the surface are afraid of being eaten themselves, so they're going to come up at night. So during the daytime, they're hiding out 300 feet down, 1,000 feet down, 2,000 feet down in relative darkness, and then their circadian rhythms tell them, hey, It's nighttime, we can come up to the surface. The surface are where the phytoplankton are, the sort of the grass, you know, like the plants that actually have to need sunlight to produce, but things that want to graze on the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, the things that want to eat the zooplankton, you know, the krill, and the things that want to eat the krill, you know, the squids and the things that eat squids. All these things then are happening at night because everything is moving up to the surface to do its feeding action. So when, if you've ever gone on a whale watching trip and you've seen some happy frolicking dolphins, you know, splashing around, it's their day off. They've been feeding all night long on squids because they've got echolocation. They don't need mm-hmm. to see the squid. They just need to ping it mm-hmm. with their sonar. So nighttime is all the same to them. So a dolphin during the day is so well fed, it's got energy to, you know, to spare, so to speak, you know, it's surplus energy. Hey, let's splash around. Let's bow ride on this whale watching boat. This seems like fun. And so they truly are happy. They truly are, as much as we can tell, right? I mean, I don't want to emphasize this, but they do seem to be just recreating. They're just sort of chilling and hanging out and splashing and leaping and showing off to each other. Hey, Mom, look at me. I can go 6 feet out of the water. And that's because they are not feeding during the day. Many dolphins, not all, but many dolphins have been feeding all night long. They are satiated with squid from this vertical migration. And then at dawn, all those animals that are feeding up on the surface slowly then descend back down into the dark ocean depths.
Wow. Yeah, that, I find that fascinating, you know, and, you know, and when I was reading about the dolphins and, you know, and how, you know, during the day they seem to play, you know, and it does, you know, have that, one does have that image of a fun and, you know, carefree, you know, dolphin, you know, spritzing across the water.
The reason I got interested in that vertical migration is actually from a photograph, which we've been talking about our cameras. I was in Indonesia, and again, aw shucks, I had to go to Bali for research. Darn it!
Darn it!
I told my wife, sorry, honey, you still have to work. I've got this year off. I'm going to go to Bali. So actually, I kind of downplayed the Bali part of it. Yeah, I'm going to Indonesia. It's going to be terrible. There won't be any toilets.
Right,
like
exactly.
It's horrible.
You don't want to go. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to know. I'll email you when I get on the boat. So anyway, I was on a boat out of Bali in Indonesia, and there was a species of dolphin there called rough-toothed dolphin, and that's from mm-hmm. the anatomy. The taxonomists were looking at the bones of the dolphin. But then it's leaping out of the water, and I took a picture. And then I'm asking myself, why are there white corsages running down the flanks of this dolphin? Like, I know, you know, like when dolphins eat squid, sometimes the squid beaks actually scar the face of the dolphin, you know, things like that. And male-on-male aggression in dolphins leaves some scars, typically around mm-hmm. the dorsal fin or around the face. But why on the side of the dolphin are these little white, you know, wedding corsages, these little prom corsages? And those were the scars from the cookie-cutter sharks. Cookie-cutter sharks are about a foot and a half long, roughly speaking, look like a big pink slug. To be honest, they're not the most attractive of things from a human perspective. I'm sure they look fine to each other, kind of like a big leech or a big, you know, big alien uh-huh. slug-like thing. And they have a round mouth just full of razor-sharp teeth. And their way of feeding is as the animals are going up from the depth to the surface in the evening to feed, including dolphins and whales, or coming back down in the morning, the cookie-cutter sharks come up to the animal in a sneak attack, grab a bite, you know, tear out a divot by turning in a circle. They pivot in a circle. They spin like they zap you in your butt, spin in a circle, yank out a mouthful of flesh, and peel away before the animals can react.
Wow.
And that leaves a scar on the side of the seal or the whale. You can look this up online for those of you too impatient to buy the book. Look it up online, cookie-cutter shark bites, and you can see them on seals and whales and dolphins. And I have seen on this rough-toothed dolphin that was leaping out of the water. So I know that it's doing at night, partly from the evidence of these ancillary scars that are along it, you know, the ancillary evidence along its flank, cookie-cutter sharks. And the reason we know about the cookie-cutter sharks, they were unknown to science. They were taking divots out of American submarine sonar ports that were covered with neoprene. Apparently neoprene and the sight of a dolphin pretty much look like the same thing if you're
their
feet, you know, below the surface. So the submarines are trying to figure out why is our sonar always messed up? And it's got all these, you know, what's been going on? We didn't hit a rock. That's not seaweed.
Right.
What's going on? And then ultimately now we know the life history of the cookie cutter shark. And if you want to see more, y'all, buy the book.
Absolutely. That's a good plug for that book. Well, you know, and I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder for a cookie cutter shark. So
I'm sure they think I'm as ugly. I'm the ugliest pink bipedal, you know, Anglo-European Caucasian mess they've ever seen. Like their hair in the wrong place, and such puny little teeth I've got, and they're sort of yellow and discolored. Like, oh, they're so horrible. You ever see those people that go swimming? They're such nasty things, those people.
Really, exactly. Now, before we close, I noticed in the book at one point you said you only mentioned climate change a couple times. You know, because you prefer to focus on the positive. But, I mean, is that, you know, am I reading that, was I reading that correctly? Or, you know, because climate change does, you know, has a big impact on the animal environment.
So, yes, I do agree. Of course, there is climate change happening. There's no doubt about that. And, of course, it does affect the natural world. But I'll just put a perspective on it that there always will be nature. 500 years from now, will I bet that there'll be human beings on this planet? I'm not positive about that. Probably we will be. Mm-hmm. Will there be nature in 500 years? Oh, sure, you betcha. There's nothing we're going to do that's going to make nature go away. The distribution of species may change. The places where we see or encounter nature may be altered from what we experience now, but nature is always going to be there. And I want your readers, your listeners to know, oh my gosh, it's still there. It has not gone away. I've been all over the world. There's still heaps and heaps and heaps of nature out there just waiting for you to participate in it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's a perfect perspective, you know, of our place in nature as part of nature. So, well, Charles, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and share your knowledge. Again, I love your book. You know, there are so many things that I've learned that I had no idea what goes on, and I can say that I probably will venture out a little bit at night prepared to be able to kind of see what I can see.
Well, thank you for this great interview. I really appreciated meeting you and talking with you.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Charles Hood, and we've been talking about his new book, Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is charleshoodbooks.com. Very easy, charleshoodbooks.com. And everyone, thank you for joining us for today's episode of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.